Welcome back to Tales of Southwest Michigan's Past. This is Michael Delaware. I am your host. Today, I wanted to explore the history of the Quakers in Southwest Michigan and their influence on modern society, as well as their influence in the past. And the Quakers were indeed the radicals of their day, being advocates of temperance, women's suffrage, and abolition during a time when these were very sensitive topics to discuss openly. Today, I have back on the program Mike Moraz with the Underground Railroad Society of Cass County, who has been on the program a few times before, and he's the president of the society. Also joining us on the program today are William and Brenda Biedenkopf, who are both Quakers and have been raised in the Quaker Church. So we're going to talk about the history of the Quakers today and also their important role in establishing the Underground Railroad in Michigan and the whole history surrounding this. So welcome, everyone. Thank you for taking time to be on the podcast today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, Mike, let's start with you. You serve as the president of the Underground Railroad Society of Cass County. When you were last on, we talked about the restoration of some of the historic landmark buildings that were part of the Underground Railroad. How's that project progressed since then?
Well, Michael, thank you again for having us. We appreciate the interest. We have a lot going on with all four facilities. It's been a pretty busy year since the last time I think we talked. I'll start with the Bonine House. We are spending a lot of time on the Bonine House aesthetics. We're finally getting to the point where we can start decorating and painting. We remodeled the second floor bath and installed some wallpaper upstairs. So that's been fun. And we also have a porch project going on, which would be the side porch of the Bonine House. We're in the process of having plans drawn up and permits pulled and working with a contractor to build the side porch. So with the aesthetics and the side porch, we're kind of finalizing, in a way, the Bonine House. So that's what's going on there. As far as the carriage house goes, we finally opened the third floor to the public, and we now have exhibits on the third floor of local family activity. Our second floor is also displays of local family vintage tools and new displays about butchering and haymaking of the 1800s. So that is ongoing, a lot new to see there. And that's our farm museum, basically. And we also hired a contractor to put in some windows. He's making windows from scratch that would look very much like they did when the 1850 carriage house was built. So we're in the process of having some windows put in and finally take some of the particle board off the windows. We can open that up, let some natural light in. So that's an exciting process for the carriage house. Moving on to the Bogue House, we restored the front of the house by removing the 1950s chimney. And we took off the aluminum siding. I painted the front of the house, and it now looks like it did originally with the front portico. And we're currently getting bids to begin refinishing the floors on the interior. So that's been part of the big part of the Bogue House project this year. And finally, we acquired the Brownsville School in November of 2022. And the fundraising is ongoing. Our contractor has done some preliminary cleanup, some carpentry repairs, and we're also put temporary tarps on the roof to keep the water out. And as a matter of fact, starting today, this morning, I met with our mason, and he started on our new foundation for the 1840s school. So that's really exciting for us. It's been a while to get all of our ducks in a row. So, like I say, a lot going on each facility, and it's been very busy, but very exciting.
So I see the picture of the Brownsville Schoolhouse on your website. Is that going to have a bell again someday when you finish the whole house up?
It will. The bell tower was taken down even before we acquired the building. The owner at the time allowed us to take that bell tower down because it was collapsing into the school itself. So we had the bell tower taken off, and that's in storage across the street from the Benign House. We will put that back on, and we don't have the original bell, but we do have a bell from another local one-room school that was only a few miles down the road from Brownsville, and that has been promised to us once we are at the point where we can put the bell tower back up and put that bell back in place. So that'll be a fun day.
Well, that's really cool. That's really cool. And of course, the Benign House has such a great Victorian look to it for the style, and it's neat to see that restored.
Absolutely. The tower is that Second Empire mansard roof style tower that was very typical of the 1870s. And that, of course, is part of the 1845 edition of the original house.
Wow. So, Brenda and William, could you give the audience a little background, perhaps, on your history and the Quaker Church a little bit?
Certainly. Brenda, do you want to go first?
Okay. I have been a member of Concord Friends Meeting near Philadelphia ever since I was just a little tyke, ever since I could just remember anything and how warm and welcoming the Quaker meeting was. It was not considered a church. It was a meeting, and they sometimes think of them as quiet meetings versus a church. But even though they were... people sat in silence and spoke in the meeting. Sometimes they were not very quiet at all. And we were involved as a child and as a teen in many of the Quaker tenets and activities, such as civil rights and peace. Then as a teen, I became heavily involved in the civil rights movement because my dad worked with Dr. King as a Quaker, a Philadelphia Quaker in the civil rights movement. He wrote training materials. He helped train the leaders of the civil rights movement. His friends were in the top tier of the movement. And they came to our house. A lot of these civil rights leaders came to our house, and they were friends of the family. And I didn't really know of anything special about them, except Dr. King, Martin Luther King. When I was about 11, I was running through the house to get to the play part of the house. And I heard this voice, and I stopped in my tracks, and I was listening to a voice that came out of the old tape player that came in the old days that they used, had these double tape things. And I was listening just rapt to the sound of this voice. And I said, "Dad, what's that? Who's that?" And he said, "That's Martin Luther King, Brenda. You're going to be hearing a lot about him in the next years." And he was right. My dad has correspondence. We have correspondence between my dad and Dr. King. They were friends, and they did work together in many of the aspects that the Quakers had taught about nonviolence, pacifism, and all of the things. And the Quakers were very determined to keep the civil rights movement nonviolent. And so they worked very heavily in that. And for my part, when I was 15, I took a bus ride from a Quaker school that lived within walking distance of me, the Westtown School. And their bus went to the March on Washington in August 23rd, 1963. And I was able to hear the I Have a Dream speech in person. And my dad was up on the dais with Dr. King. My family saw him come out and look over the crowd. He was one of the marshals. And he was also, his title was deputy coordinator for the Philadelphia area. Wow. And they were all deputies. So that didn't mean he was second in command, but he was very, very active. And that really changed my life to hear the I Have a Dream speech as a young teenager. Also, I was pulled into the Underground Railroad Society of Cass County here because I knew that I had Quaker ancestors in the Philadelphia area that ran the Underground Railroad in that area. So this intrigued me, and I wanted to find out more. I had no idea that there were Quaker lines and there were Underground Railroad lines in the Midwest, and that there was all this goings on. So Will and I are now members of Penn. We're members of the board, both of us. And I am known as a Quaker historian.
Awesome.
Will?
My Quaker history is not nearly as glorious as Brenda's. I can remember probably the earliest, my earliest memory of going to a Quaker meeting was probably fourth or fifth grade. My parents had moved to the Albany, New York area where I grew up when I was about 4 years old. But I don't remember attending a meeting until probably 8 or 9 or 10 years old. And we met at that time in the YMCA building in Albany, New York. And I remember the noisy wooden stairs because our first day school class would tromp up the stairs for the last 15 minutes of the silent meeting. It was a silent or unprogrammed meeting as compared to the more in the Midwest meetings that are, or churches that they call, are called in the Midwest, which have pastors, but they're still Friends churches, Friends being the Religious Society of Friends being the official name of Quakers. And I too attended the March on Washington because of our Quaker belief. Both my father and mother were very much involved in civil rights, and my dad especially wanted to go to the March on Washington, so we went on the charter bus down there. It really didn't mean as much to me because I didn't have a dad who was Martin Luther King or anything like that.
Lucky Brenda.
I didn't know my future wife at that time. I had no clue that she was there and that it was really meaningful to her. I was just a teenage boy experiencing a huge crowd on a hot summer day that someday would mean something. And then we married after our first year of college. It was a Quaker college called Friends World College, and the goal of this school was to travel around the world, spending 6 months in each of campuses around the world. And so we had gone to Mexico, spent time in Mexico, and I got to know Brenda there. She was in that school, which where I really met her and came to know her. And we got married after that first year. Had our kids in Pennsylvania and moved to Michigan in 1986. And there were we didn't find any or were not aware of any Quaker meetings in our area. So we attended a Presbyterian church for 14 years and then discovered Penn Friends Community Church, it was called at that time, up at Cassopolis. And our first visit there, we fell in love with it, said, this is where we belong. And then Brenda told you about getting involved with the Underground Railroad.
Wow. Now, just from a historical context, we have a Quaker park here in Battle Creek, and I did some videos on that, and I was interested and curious about the history, you know, how the services were held in a Quaker meeting house. And my understanding is that it was different than what most people today might think of conventional religion, where you have a minister at a pulpit and everybody's going along with the service, whereas the meeting houses, traditionally, they had the women stay on one side of the room and the men on the other, and there was sometimes a wall or partition between the two. And there was no central minister. It was a time of prayer and reflection. Am I getting that correct? Is that kind of...
That is correct, yes. Okay. And more than just prayer and reflection, but waiting on the Holy Spirit to inspire someone to preach, to testify what God wants them to say.
I see. Okay.
And the women were separated from the men because if a woman was standing next to her husband or sitting next to her husband in the meeting, she was not as likely to stand up and speak as she would be if she were with other women and encouraged to speak. And so the Quaker women were very good speakers because of that. And they were not only ministers, but they were officers, and they had their own concerns. They wrote their own minutes, and their business meetings were separate.
Oh, interesting.
But this was to encourage the women. It wasn't like in a Jewish congregation, the women are separated because they're inferior mm-hmm. to the men. And this was not the same at all. This was because the women were equal, and they wanted to encourage them to work on women's issues.
Well, you know, and as that kind of makes sense now, having that explained a little bit, because that would kind of lead me to the next question, because historically the Quakers were often regarded as kind of the radicals of their day in the 1800s. You know, could you maybe elaborate a little bit about what that was?
I would love to, because I came from a radical Quaker family. We actually said thee and thy in our meetings, and it was a really a beautiful way to be raised. But as far as how were the Quakers the radicals of their day, and how did they set the tone for the kind of egalitarian society that we live in today? Uh-huh. They were a religious group founded in the 1600s in England, and they were most known for their anti-slavery stance, because they believed it was a sin against God and man, but also their belief in the equality of women, and also their humane treatment of the Indians or the Native Americans and the mentally ill. The Quakers were founded by George Fox, not William Penn. A lot of people think that it was founded by William Penn, but Penn was a follower of Fox. And Penn had the prestige, he had the money, he had the titles. And so Charles II gave him Pennsylvania as a colony, and he was the proprietor, but he was a radical proprietor. Uh-huh. He was required by his patents from King Charles 1681 to write the Constitution, to establish the laws, to establish the legislature and all the things that were needed in order to have a colony. And he, instead of wanting to go to the colonies and subdue them, kill everybody or almost everybody and subdue the rest, he said, let us see what love can do and what the Bible teaches. And so he went there and he treated the Indians, the Native Americans, with dignity and respect. He respected their culture. He joined them in their councils. He ran races and played games with them. And actually in the races, he won many of them. Yeah. He was very athletic and he was a young man. He also insisted that the settlers had to pay a fair price for the land. And this would a price that would have been such as they would have had to pay in England, whereas in Boston, as we know, they just gave the Indians a few trinkets.
Right, right.
And so he was a very radical proprietor. And also another thing they believed was important was, instead of slavery, these Quakers believed that your workforce was your family. You came with 10 kids. You had 11 mm-hmm. kids. This was your workforce. You didn't need slaves. If you didn't have enough people, then the next thing was indentured servants.
Right.
And the Quakers relied heavily on indentured servants. And this was a contract that was gone into legally and by choice. Nobody was forced to sign this paper, but it was a contract. And if you know what an indentured servant was, that the colonists would pay for somebody's passage to come over, and they would agree to work for 5 or 7 years, however the contract said. Yeah. And then at the end, they were to be given some money to pay for to get out into the world. So I don't consider that to be a lot more different from how our young people today say, mm-hmm. okay, get me through college,
right.
Pay my loans and grants, and then I'll pay you back. And so I think that that's indentured servitude to the government. So it's really not a bad thing. And William Penn had a manor called Pensbury Manor, and it was run by about 200 indentured servants.
Yeah.
There were two slaves, which he freed in his will. And my ancestors, the Walkers, I'm Brenda Walker Badenkoff. My dad was Charlie Walker. They were the founders of Valley Forge. And they had a huge family and some indentured servants. And I never found any slaves at all in my ancestry. So I'm rather proud of that. Mm. In 1676, before Penn came over in 1683, George Fox traveled to the colonies, and he was urging all the Quakers there to free their slaves and provide for their future. In 1688, which was after Penn had been there for a few years, there was the first official written protest against slavery, or official or written, and it was written by the Friends of Germantown Friends Meeting near Philadelphia. Okay. And it emphasized the Golden Rule. Would you like to be a slave?
Right.
Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. There were some other very important things. They helped set the tone for getting rid of titles and inherited titles, the nobility. And you know, though, as you look around, we don't see dukes and earls and so forth over here in the United States, because the Friends said that if you had an inherited title, you had to give it up to be a Quaker, because we are all equal in the sight of the law and in the sight of God. Hmm. And these were radical things. They caused a lot of trouble. The Quakers, because of their belief in the equality and not having people over you, they wouldn't take their hats off.
Yeah.
They wouldn't take their hats off to the judges and the kings, and they were dragged off to jail. Another thing the Quakers were very forward on was the abolition of slavery. And in England, in 1807, you know, that's very early. We didn't abolish it till the 1860s. In 1807, they gave up the slave trade.
Yep.
And that was we're not bringing any more in.
Yep.
We're going to leave the ones here, but we're not going to bring any more in. And that really slowed it down a lot. But then in 1833, about 20 years later, they abolished the institution altogether, again, largely due to the pressure put on the Parliament by the Quakers.
Yeah.
And this helped set the tone in the colonies to do the same. Then also, as Levi Coffin was considered the president of Underground Railroad, and he lived in Indiana near us, there was a lady named Laura Haviland. She was considered the superintendent of the Underground Railroad. Of all the people in the East and in the South, everywhere, she was considered the superintendent, and she lived in Adrian, Michigan,
okay,
near Detroit. She was an amazing lady. Before the Civil War, around 1840, she shuttled thousands of freedom seekers through Detroit on into Canada. And in 1846, I mean, this was like 20 years before the Civil War, Haviland, she was Michigan's most famous Quaker. She succeeded in keeping a family of slaves out of the clutches of the slave hunters, who finally overtook Haviland on a train in Ohio.
Interesting.
And at gunpoint demanded the return of their property. Well, Haviland said, "Well, man, I fear neither thy weapons nor thy threats. They are powerless.
Wow.
Thee is not at home. Thee is not in Tennessee. As for thy property, I have none of it about me or on my premises."
Wow.
So, you know, she really stuck up for herself and for what she believed in. She had a $3,000 bounty put on her head by the slave hunters.
Wow.
And she also formed the Raisin Institute. And it was the first school for Black children in Michigan, and one of the first in the nation. And then just one other little thing about how radical the Quakers were. I wanted to say something about my ancestor, Lindley Coates. He was my direct ancestor. So my grandma was a Coates. Mm-hmm. My dad was Charles Coates Walker. They were Quakers. And he lived in the Lancaster area near Philadelphia in Christiana, which was right near where my dad grew up. And he helped form the early Clarkson Anti-Slavery Society.
Interesting.
And then after that, he was president of the American Anti-Slavery Society and helped form that with William Lloyd Garrison, who became president after him. And as so you can see that how the Quakers were the radicals of their day. And they developed this egalitarian society, which we now accept as normal today. And so a bit later, maybe I'll tell you about the women's suffrage movement, because that was another huge thing that was important to the Quakers.
So let me ask William, who were some of the key Quaker leaders in the Underground Railroad in, I guess, either in Cass County or in Michigan that...
All right. Well, now, Brenda has mentioned already Levi Coffin and Laura Haviland. Mm-hmm. And they were, of course, Levi Coffin was called the president of the Underground Railroad. But I have to start with Charles Osborne was an older Quaker. He was born in Ohio. North Carolina, moved to Ohio. Mm-hmm. And he was a minister, Quaker minister, and traveled all around, Charles Osborne. And his son, Josiah Osborne, was also one of the important people in the Cass County area. Charles Osborne didn't move there until 1941, but he traveled around Michigan, around the United States, and even in Europe, preaching the gospel and preaching abolitionism. And he founded a newspaper, an anti-slavery newspaper in Ohio called, help me, Brenda.
The Philanthropist.
And wrote one of the first articles, or possibly the first article published in a newspaper against slavery.
Wow, that must have been well received at that time.
Yeah. So he didn't get to Michigan until 1842. Uh-huh. He had been in Ohio and Indiana. Stephen Bogue was one of the foremost conductors, station masters on the Underground Railroad. Uh-huh. And he had been in Ohio and Indiana. He was a leader in the Indiana yearly meeting of the Religious Society of Friends, Quakers. And they kicked him out in 1842 because he was so outspoken. And every time he would talk, he would be preaching abolitionism. And the Quakers were very much against slavery, but they weren't all in agreement about how to proceed. Some said, okay, we've got to do this legally. Others said, well, this is an evil thing, and we've got to help those poor slaves who are escaping. We've got to give them succor. We've got to help them. Right. We've got to get them to Canada. That was against the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a serious split in the Quaker organizations, and many of the ones who joined these abolitionist societies were actually, they call it, disowned or kicked out of their Quaker meetings, out of their local monthly meetings, and out of the yearly meetings too, as was Stephen Bogue. So at that point he said, I'm moving to Michigan, and there was a thriving Quaker community there in Cass County, and he moved to Michigan and started an anti-slavery society there. Actually, a Quaker was called the Anti-Slavery Friends Yearly Meeting.
Okay.
And so Stephen Bogue became a station master on the Underground Railroad. Having friends aiding people seeking their freedom, whom we call now freedom seekers instead of fugitive slaves.
Okay.
Fugitive slaves emphasizes being a lawbreaker, whereas everyone should be guaranteed their freedom. And his daughter, Sarah Bogue, married James E. Bonine, and the Bonine House is, of course, the center for the Underground Railroad Society.
I see. Did James Bonine actually become a station master himself?
He actually did.
Okay.
Maybe not right away. We don't know exactly when he would have done that because he got married in 1844. For some reason, he wanted to build a house in 1845.
Yeah.
And he didn't build the carriage house until 1850. And that's where there's actual evidence and accounts of the freedom seekers being sheltered on the third floor of the carriage house.
Okay.
So he may not have engaged in that immediately, but one of the significant things about James E. Bonine is in 1853, he purchased a section, 640 acres, and allowed freedom seekers and free blacks of that time to live on it, to farm 5 or 10 acres, keep all the profits from their work, build cabins, send their kids to school. And that became a little village with about 100 people, maybe 30, they say between 50 and 100 cabins possibly. Nobody knows for sure, but a community called Ramptown. They
right.
called it Ramptown
right.
after the ramp or the wild beast that grew in that area. So that's a notable for James Bonine. There were, because it was a Quaker community and many of the Quakers there were involved as station masters. Zachariah Sugart was one. He was a storekeeper. He was one of the few who actually kept records because he was a storekeeper between 1841 and 1846. He recorded the names of 137 freedom seekers that he helped on the way to freedom.
Was that in Cass County that he did that? Or?
That was in Cass County. Yes. And he would usually take these people up to Schoolcraft to Dr. Nathan and Camellia Thomas.
Okay.
Who were the station masters in Schoolcraft. And Camellia Thomas wrote one time, she said, "Often after my little ones were asleep and I thought the labor of the day was over, Friend Sugart would drive up with a load of hungry people to be fed and housed for the night." So being a station master was not a guarantee of peace and tranquility.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read the interview that Erastus Hussey gave before he died. He was the station master here in Battle Creek. And there's a lot of fascinating material that he provided in that interview, because he gave, between Battle Creek and Cass County, there it was a farm in Climax was the stop that was next to him. And then from there, I think there was one in Mendon or something like that. And then it either went to... They either came from that route through Schoolcraft, or they went through straight over into Cassopolis area where the Bonine house would have been. And then west, they would have gone to Marshall. But there was also another leg that for a short time that went north up to, they took them over to Port Huron instead of straight to Detroit, that I found out based on some old maps. And Battle Creek was like the point where they changed directions if they did go that way. But and then he also mentioned there was another one out in Grass Lake, Michigan, after you left Marshall. And he mentioned a couple other ones. I think there was one in Ann Arbor, and then over into it went over to Detroit from there.
There was one in Parma, and there was one in Jackson.
Yep, Parma and Jackson. I think, Parma. They went Grass Lake, Parma, and Jackson. Those were the stops on that area. Yeah. Very fascinating history. It'd be neat to see how many of those old buildings, if there are any, remaining. I know Battle Creek doesn't have any more standing buildings from that era, but it's fascinating that that you've been able to preserve the properties there in Cass County.
it is unique that we actually have the building still standing.
Yeah, there's not many. I think the Schoolcraft one has one too, right? The doctor's house and Schoolcraft.
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. Dr. Nathan and Amelia Thomas. Yes, it has been moved. It used to be on one side of the town, and they moved it for some reason to the other side. There.
And I understand there's one in Union City that is still standing that had come up a route that came through Union City.
We were spared the
name is escaping
me right now.
We were spared
the urban sprawl. I think it's urban sprawl that got rid of a lot of the old buildings as the city started to grow. Luckily, Cassopolis and Vandalia has stayed small villages, and I think that's kind of what helped preserve the buildings we have now.
Well, let's go take a look at some of the other radical topics that the Quakers were known to kind of shake the tree with back in the day. One of them was women's suffrage, right?
Right.
You want to talk a little bit about that, Brenda?
Yes, I'm excited about the women's suffrage story. One of the important tenets of the Quakers was a belief in the equality of women. And from the very beginning, women could speak and preach in meeting, and they could serve as ministers and officers. And this was quite odious to many of the other religions, like the Catholics, who kept trying to shut them down. Mm-hmm. And unlike other religious groups, the Quaker women, they could inherit property. With the other groups, they went straight from the man to his sons, and the women did not inherit the property. However, my Quaker ancestor, Mary Walker, who was one of the settlers of Valley Forge, the Walkers settled Valley Forge, she inherited the property from her husband. Mm-hmm. And so this was a very new thing. They could sign contracts, they could conduct their own business, they could be on juries. They could own their own cottage industries. For example, they could sell their own eggs, chickens, baked goods, any new clothing they made, and any other businesses that people would pay for. And women in other religious groups who needed money, they would have to hire themselves out as servants or laborers. Quaker women, they conducted their own separate business meetings, and they were separate from the men. And a lot of the women were concerned with education, the mentally ill, the nurture of children, and prison reform. On the Underground Railroad, such as what we've been talking about this morning, women station masters are listed along with their men. Zachariah and Susanna Shugart, Erastus and Sarah Hussey, Levi and Catherine Coffin, and it went on and on, Ishmael and Miriam Lee, Stephen and Hannah Bogue. They did as much work as the men, and they were acknowledged for it. They were very respected in the Quakers. Wow. And all through the anti-slavery movement, the Quaker women supported their men. Now, this was an ongoing thing from the 1820s on. And they traveled with them, and they spoke out for the cause when they were allowed. Sometimes they were considered a distraction to have women around. But one such couple was James and Lucretia Mott. You might have heard the name Lucretia Mott. She was a very important Quaker. And she was very, very active in the women's movement. But before that, she worked with her man, with James, to get the black man his vote. And after the 14th Amendment was passed for the black vote, it granted citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the United States, including formerly enslaved people. Then Lucretia famously said, "We helped get the black man his right to vote. Now it's our turn." And the Quaker men then happily supported their women as they traveled around and spoke in favor of the women's right to vote, which was also called women's suffrage. Now, Lucretia was an amazing leader in the movement. Mm-hmm. She grew up in Nantucket Island in Rhode Island, daughter of a seafaring man who was gone on the sea for like a year at a time. The women who were left behind had to run the business, not just their homes, but the businesses, the island trade, the economy. And they were very eloquent and intelligent in all of their business dealings and in their speeches. Now, four out of the five women who called the women's rights, it was the very first women's rights convention, were Quakers, with Lucretia being the main one, And Elizabeth Cady Stanton was the only organizer of this. It was called the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848. Mm-hmm. And she was the only one who was not a Quaker. And this was about 20 years before the Civil War that the women were starting to rabble rouse. Frederick Douglass was the only African-American in attendance, and he gave an impassioned speech for women's rights. Now, later, Lucretia and James moved to the Philadelphia area because they were having some problems where they did live. And they became really big in the anti-slavery and the women's movement there in Philadelphia. Lucretia did two things that made some of the people mad. She traveled around with Black women companions as well as white women companions. And there was a mob that formed. They were so mad. They formed and burned down Philadelphia Hall that had just been built for the abolitionists to meet in. And this mob was headed to burn down the Mott's home. But the plan was foiled because a friend of theirs positioned himself at the front of the mob, and he yelled, "On to the Mott's," and proceeded to rush the mob on past the Mott's home.
Oh, wow.
So he just pulled them off, and they never did find the Mott's place to burn it down. And the abolitionist group, unfazed, met at a different building on the following day. The Quakers helped set the tone in education with their belief that women should have an equal education to men. And James Mott, with Lucretia having a hand in it, founded Swarthmore College. You might have heard of Swarthmore, as a co-educational school. Very forward-thinking. And William Penn, when he came over, he said the girls should be educated along with the boys. This was not done in the other colonies. And in the Quaker boarding schools, the girls were also educated in everything that the boys were: the sciences, math, economics, mm-hmm. history. Now, another Quaker woman who was very important was Susan B. Anthony.
Yeah.
Her mother and sister had attended the Seneca Falls Convention, so she was aware of the struggle for women's rights. She became quite an activist, and so she was aware. She became arrested for voting. She went and voted in violation of the law that she wasn't allowed. So at there was a widely publicized trial. She was convicted. She was guilty of voting against the law, but she refused to pay the fine. Now, nobody followed up on it. That's the good news on that. And but then she was not allowed to speak at temperance meetings. That means the meetings against alcohol, because she was a female.
Wow.
And in the early days, she was verbally attacked for her views and accused of trying to destroy the institution of marriage. If women have the vote, the men will lose complete control of their families. And that's the kind of thing that they were worried about if the women had the vote.
Hmm.
Now, Susan B. Anthony, who we're talking about, she was a very, very bright student at her Quaker boarding school. But when she graduated, she had a rude awakening because she found out there were very few high-level jobs for females. And if she did get one, they were paid less than half of what a man would get for the very same work. So she became a proponent of equal pay for equal work.
Wow, way back then. Wow.
Yes. And she also famously said, "Men, their rights and nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
Women, their rights and nothing less." And the harsh criticism of her views changed over the years because she was patient and persistent. But later she was hailed as a hero. In her later years, she was invited to the White House. She was the first woman placed on a U.S. coin, mm-hmm. and that was on the 1979 dollar. Right. Now, I want to mention briefly, there's a third Quaker woman worth mentioning, is Alice Paul. Alice Paul, she graduated from Swarthmore College, so she was one of the younger generation. Mm-hmm. These older ladies had been working since, 1840s, mm-hmm. and they were sort of running out of steam. So in the 1900s, the women's suffrage was just taking off. And so Alice Paul was one of the younger leaders. And her story is told in the movie Iron-Jawed Angels. And it stars Hilary Swank and Patrick Dempsey, along with Angelica Houston, a lot of famous actors and actors. You would just love to see the movie.
Yeah.
And her most famous saying was, "Most reforms are complicated, but nothing is complicated about ordinary equality." And this was a 60-year movement ending in 1920 with the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote.
Yep. I was just looking at that online here. So that's the Woodrow Wilson administration that finally passed that, even though Theodore Roosevelt and William Taft were big advocates of it as well, but could never get it passed through Congress, could never muster the support of it. It's kind of an interesting history, how it finally built up and passed in the 1920. There were other issues that you mentioned, temperance briefly. You know, how is that today? Is it alcohol still something that the Quakers' position on alcohol, has that changed over the years, or is it in the Quaker society of friends today, is it still something that they don't engage in, is alcohol?
Quakers today have changed in that regard. There's a lot more freedom for individuals in the regard to that, but they still maintain that you should not be controlled by alcohol.
I see. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. That's common sense.
Now, my parents did not drink or smoke. Mm-hmm. The only dancing that we were allowed to do really was square dancing and folk dancing, which was very non-sexy or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It was really terrific stuff. But I was glad that my parents didn't smoke and drink and that kind of stuff. It was very important.
Yeah, well, you probably got a lot more out of your childhood in a lot of other ways that if you didn't have to deal with all that, too, you know, because that can go down a very dark path with some people.
Yes.
So let's talk about the Underground Railroad Society of Cass County. William, where can people go to find out more about the Bonine House and other places? Are you guys having any summer tours coming up that they should look out for?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So there's three things that I think of in that regard. One is our website, mm-hmm. urscc.org. And much of our research can be accessed through our website. Also, our library at the Bonine House that has work by various historical researchers, plus a lot of family records of all the families that were in the area in the 1860 census, I believe. And then, yes, definitely this summer, second weekend of July, I think that's 12th, 13th, and 14th, is the Underground Railroad Days Festival in Vandalia.
Oh, okay.
There will be speakers, I believe, was it 182nd Colored Troops?
Yeah, we're hoping on the 102nd Colored Troops will be there. Yeah, it's 102nd.
Okay.
Yeah, we're hoping they will be there. So far, we believe they will be, and they put on a great program, very educational, and they'll tell you about the day life of a Civil War soldier, especially being a black soldier in the 1860s. So we hope to have them as well.
That's great. That's great. So any last-minute information you'd like to share, Brenda, about the Quakers and the history of the Quaker Church and all of the issues maybe we've talked about today?
Yeah, there were a couple of things that I would like to share, that that William Penn felt that his first calling was to free the Quakers because they were not free, they were persecuted, mm-hmm. and they were still under the crown here in the colonies. But he still had a very much of concern about slavery in the colonies. Yeah. And he tried to stop it. There were two things that he did. He wanted the slaves to be able to marry. He wanted them to have families and to have children and have strong family units. And he urged the legislature to pass a law that the slaves could get married, but the legislature wouldn't do it. And since he was not a dictator, he didn't force them. That one didn't go over well. There was a second thing that he wanted to do was he wanted to establish a heavy tax on the slave trade to slow mm-hmm. it down. And the colonists thought, oh, that's a great idea. They passed it. However, King Charles, the crown, nixed that law because it was one of the things that Charles II could do was to veto any law that William Penn and the legislature had passed. So the two things that he worked very hard for and were concerned for did not take place, but he did free his two slaves in his will, which also set the tone for a lot of the founders. Later on, 100 years later, they, almost all of them, freed their slaves in their will because they hated the institution of slavery. And we were talking about Erastus Hussey, and I just wanted to tell a story about Hussey that his wife was Sarah and his daughter was Susan. And there was one day in 1847 when a huge group of freedom seekers came up. They went through Schoolcraft, and then they went to Flower Field first and then Schoolcraft. And this was led by Friend Shugart, who Will referred to. And they said that he arrived on a fine horse with his white Quaker hat. And the Quakers always had fine horses. And he was also accompanied by a free black man, Henry Shepherd, who had agreed to help bring these people up. And they had just been through a huge trial where slave owners had come from Kentucky to try to take these black people back. And the Quakers did not allow them to do that. There was a big trial. And in the trial, actually, the black people were allowed to testify against the white slave owners. And this was very unusual in that time. And the blacks accused the whites of battery and assault and battery, this kind of thing. It was very, very interesting kind of thing that happened and actually changed some of the ways that our laws were made. And the Kentuckians went back furious that they didn't have a thing because the Quakers had turned them away. And there were 9 fugitives that were ready to go on that were freed. And they were joined by 31 others who were feeling pretty nervous because they felt like there were slave catchers all over the area. They wanted to get to Canada. And so this group of 40 people, plus there was a dozen people who came along, men who came along as escorts to make sure that they were guarded and were not molested further. And they called this, I think that it was in Erastus Hussey's journal or Susan, it was in one of their journals that it was like a parade coming through at midnight, and people came out of their homes to see this huge parade of people coming through Battle Creek. And they stopped at the Hussey's house and woke up the people who were sleeping there, of course, and it was Erastus and his daughter Susan, and the mom was gone. So Susan had to jump in and do everything that needed to be done. Here are all these people who needed to be fed. And so Erastus ran out into the community and begged about 3 bags of potatoes, huge bags of potatoes, and a couple of bags of flour. And so the women in the group helped Susan bake all these potatoes or cook them and then make bread. And so everybody had a chance to eat. And that night in Erastus Hussey's home, in the Hussey home, there was much singing and dancing and eating, and I believe the sound of freedom. Yeah.
Very much the case. Yeah, there's a, they actually housed them in a, see, there was only about 3 or 4 people that knew about the Underground Railroad. Hussey kept it under wraps, and his sister, his daughter, Susan, was one of them, and then, of course, his wife. And there was one other, I think Perry Stanford came with that group. But there was one other person, and he had to go and confide in another man that evening because he got 1 hour's notice they were coming, and the space that he had was not big enough for that crowd. So he had to go confide in this man that he wasn't sure about, but he had to take a chance, and the guy was totally on board with letting him use like a barn or a stable that he had, and that's what they kept him in overnight. And it was actually the fugitives themselves that cooked their own dinner. And they were just excited, you know. They just brought in all the food, and they brought a big pot, and I think Susan helped them, but they all got involved in cooking the food, is what I understand. And it was just kind of a big celebration. Yeah. They were happy to. You know, the Hussies were concerned about the accommodations, but they were just thrilled, you know, that they had a big meal. So
that was such a wonderful story. I love that story.
Very nice. So any last minute comments you want to make, William? About the history, maybe the Quakers, or something you might want to leave with people knowing about the Quaker faith that they don't perhaps know about today?
I would like to say that our church, Penn Friends, has gone through a number of iterations. It was Penn Friends Meeting when it was originally founded. Actually, the precursor was Birch Lake Meeting. Then it became Prairie Grove Meeting, and then was offered land up in Penn Township, became Penn Friends Meeting, and then Penn Friends Church. They actually had their first pastor in 1937. Wow. And so it's been a pastored church since then. Although I think on one of our vendors, we still get bills addressed to Penn Friends Meeting. But today, it's very similar to many other Christian churches. We have a worship team with guitars. I play trombone in it. We sing popular Christian songs. Although we begin each service with a hymn, and Quaker hymn of some sort, and it's so very similar to many other churches that are around.
Where is it located? Is it Cassopolis or is it somewhere else?
It is technically Cassopolis.
Okay.
But it is by miles, probably closer to Vandalia.
Oh, okay.
If you go through Cassopolis on M60 and turn north on Penn Road, or if you come up from Indiana on Calvin Center Road, just keep on heading north for about 2 miles, and it's up there. There was a Quaker meeting in Vandalia, and James Bonine's brother, Lot Bonine, I think, had a brick kiln on his farm, and provided the bricks for not only James E.'s house, but also for the meeting house in Vandalia. But that has since fallen down.
Okay.
There was the membership was low, and it was not used. It was used by the Masons to hold their meetings in for a while, and then when they abandoned it, it just decayed. But Mike saved many of the bricks from that structure to using repairs on Bonine House.
Oh, great. Great. Well, Mike, if somebody wanted to make a donation or maybe become a member of the Underground Rail Society of Cass County or wanted to donate to the work that you're doing to help restore the buildings, would they just go to the website?
I think the website's the best opportunity, urscc.org. And there's a variety of ways to contact us, whether you want to be a member or whether you'd like to donate. If you'd like to volunteer, you can reach out to us. There's information opportunity. To echo what Will said, you know, we have a lot of information there on the website. So urscc.org, and that would be the best way to contact us if you'd like to schedule a tour. We're also open during the summer months, generally 1 to 4, 1 to 5 during the week, and occasionally on weekends, depending upon our volunteers. So if you see an open sign outside the Bonine House on M60, please feel free to stop in and you can get a tour, or again, contact us at urscc.org.
Okay, great. And I will add the link in the show note descriptions for everybody who's out there listening to the show, and maybe you're driving down the road. So if you want to check that out, there is a ton of information that can keep you busy for several hours, maybe days, on this website. There's just tons of stuff on here. But it's really great. You guys have done a wonderful job, and I thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. So I've been speaking with members of the Underground Railroad Society of Cass County. I've had Brenda and William Biedenkopf and Mike Meraz. And it's just been fascinating to hear all of the history of the Quakers and a lot of the people that were involved with the Underground Railroad way back then and some of the buildings and structures. And we could probably talk for another hour and fill you up with a lot of information. So we may just have to have them back on again in the future. But if you would like to reach out to me, you can find me at michaeldelaware.com. I'm always happy to hear from my listeners. And if you enjoyed today's show, please leave a rating or review on whatever app that you are listening on. And until next time, when we take another journey into yesterday and we explore even more fascinating tales of Southwest Michigan's past, thank you for listening.